This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Common denominator between this talk and my next week's talk is really that they're my two raciest talks. And I just want to say right up front that I am really a nice Orthodox girl. Most of the time, I'm a really nice Orthodox girl. This talk is a little racy. Next week is even a little racier. So let's warm. I just thank you to the familiar faces and to the new people. The people that I haven't met, I look forward to getting to know you. My name is Mish Hammer Kasoy. This is my 20th year teaching at Machon Pardes. It's also, that's it. I'm originally from D.C. Let's start with disability because it's a soft warm-up for me. It's source number 2, actually, on your source sheet. I couldn't decide about the order. You don't all have source sheets? Well, there's plenty. Here we go. Let's send these back. Thank you, Renee. Okay, now does everyone have? Here, Aaron. Okay. Okay, the title for the recording, they'll say it, I think. The People Have Spoken, Gay Marriage, Female Orthodox Rabbis, and Disability. How long does tradition think we should wait for the rabbis to step up? More? Who wants to? Renee, why don't you read? Start from the Gemara in Source 2. Right where it says the Gemara, in the middle of source 2, it's on page 1. Rav Huna said, I'm sorry, source number 2, Rav Huna said, in the middle of it.
Okay, Rav Huna said, a man whose eyes run should not lift up his hands. But was there not one in the neighborhood of Rav Huna who used to spread water to him? The townspeople had become accustomed to him. It had been taught to the same effect. A man whose eyes run should not lift up his hands. But if the townspeople are accustomed to him, he is permitted. Rabbi Jonathan said, a man blind in one eye should not lift up his hands. But was not there one in the neighborhood of Rabbi Jonathan who used to lift up his hands? The townspeople were accustomed to him. It has been taught to the same effect. A man blind in one eye should not lift up his hands. But if the townspeople are accustomed to him, it is permitted.
Okay. I forgot about the people that are listening by recording that I'm not allowed to let other people read. So, Renee, thank you for doing that first one. And the Kohen, the priest, is really an agent, which means that he represents both the people and God. And sometimes the representative of God, and sometimes the representative people. And that's why it makes perfect sense that there's going to be very high standards for that person, for the Kohen, in terms of levels of purity that he has to maintain, that restrictions on who he's allowed to marry, if he is ever involved in a killing, God forbid, he can never bless people again, and he cannot have some sort of a deformity, and especially a deformity on his hands or face. As a representative of God, God dwells between the king's finger, between the Kohen's fingers, and that's why we turn away, right? You know why we turn away when God. There's some source sheets. There's some source sheets over here and here. That's why we turn away, just in case. We shouldn't look at God and go blind. because we know that someone can't see God, you can't see God. Okay, so that's the situation here, and that's where our Gemara takes off. Okay, that's what the Gemara says. What if you the Mishnah? I mean, I'm sorry. The opening of the Braita. There's how many people don't have source sheets? Okay. So the Rav Huna, the Braita, the tradition between the Mishnah and the Gemara that I've cited for you here says that a man who's if there's something wrong with you, if there's something, there's a deformity of some kind in your face, including you're not allowed to raise your hands and bless the people. And Rav Huna says, if your eyes are running, you shouldn't lift up your hands. And he said, that's a very clear position. No, okay, you may not do it. And a strong position that we want to be strict about how we're defining deformities and abnormalities, and it's a little bit exclusive. It's about honor of the temple. It's about decorum. Deborah, there's an original on my desk if you want to make five more or so. Okay, I'm going to warm up. Don't worry. This is like a little hard of a distracting beginning, but I'm going to, don't worry. I'll take over. Where were we? Yeah. Honor, decorum. This is, you're representing all of the Jewish people before God. You're representing God before the Jewish people. You've got to have the highest of standards. Would you be willing to you bring to God what you would bring to the governor. If you would go this way to the president, that's how you can do it. And Rav Huna is strict. But then what happens in the Gemara? That's the statement of Rav Huna. And then the Gemara asks, but was there not one in the neighborhood of Rav Huna who used to do it this way? Okay, he has a rule, which is no, you're excluded, you can't participate. And then he doesn't follow through with his rule. Okay, that's what happens, and that happens twice. Both Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan, neither of them follow through with their rule, and the Gemara wants to know what's going on here. Okay, what's going on here? How can the Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan, both of them have rules excluding people with moderate abnormalities, and then they don't follow through? Why not? Real question. What? The people are used to it. Okay, which means? Okay, that's what Rashi says. Once you get used to it, you're not distracted anymore and it's all good. Okay, I'd like to suggest there's a little something more going on here. Another possibility in addition to that. Tell me your name.
My name is Shira.
Shira. So the people don't mind, so that works. Okay, I'd love to hear another thing. Okay, if you're Rav Huna or Rabbi Yochanan, and someone walks into your shul, you be the one that goes up to him and says, "Sorry, but you're deformed. We don't want you to blame for us. We don't want you to raise your hands for us." Okay, Rav Huna, it's one thing to be the Rosh Yeshiva, to sit in the Beit Midrash and say, sorry, you know, you're not the standard that we want. You're distracting. We're bothered by your looks. It's another thing to go up to the person and say, you really, I'm sorry, but, okay? It's hard to say that nicely. And the natural inclination, it's not just about that it's not. And remind me your name, because we've met. You. Mm-hmm. Vera. As Vera said, it's people get used to it, but you learn to get used to it. You learn to accustom yourself to a person. You realize that they're just a person, and it's no longer as strange, and so you get over yourself. And Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan had this idea in their ivory tower that we're going to be exclusive. We're going to hold ourselves to a very high standard. And then when they meet the people, they think, do I really want to be so exclusive? Do I really want to leave someone out? Let me see if I can, maybe I can get used to it. Okay? I can get used to it. Tell me your name.
Benji.
Just
regarding the Kohanim. Uh-huh. In the Torah, when it raises this point that they shouldn't go up, it also talks about things that are not, that you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering how that plays part.
I think there's more going on in the Torah, but I'm not going to have enough time to deal with that, but I think your question is a good one, Benji. Okay? Right, but I would look at Rashi there. That's my first point is that there's no judgment on behalf of the part of the Gemara here. It's okay to have they have a theoretical standard. When they meet the people face to face, their standards shift a little bit because they want to human interaction tempers their ideology, but in a good way. In a good way. Let's look at another source. Yes, Vera. Right, that's why Rabbi Yochanan and Rav Huna are like, forget about it, I can't do this.
That's exactly it. I think they realize that that's not what Judaism is all about.
And sometimes you only realize that when you're actually looking the person in the eye, right? When you're sitting in your ivory tower, you don't feel it in the same way as when you're looking the person in the eye. I think that things are different. Okay, Mishnah Yadayim. It's numbered one again. Sorry, that's the computer. The top of page two. I'm going to read because otherwise it won't come out good in the recording. On that very day, Yehuda, an Ammonite convert, came and stood before them in the Beit Midrash and said to them, "What is my status with regard to whether I can enter via marriage into the congregation of Israel? Ma ani levo b'kahal. Ma ani levo b'kahal. Can I join the congregation?" Rabban Gamliel said to him, "You are prohibited." Rabbi Yoshua said, "Of course you can join the kahal. Permitted." Rabban Gamliel said to him, "But the Torah says, Lo yavo amoni umovi b'kal Hashem gam zor asiri. An Ammonite and a Moabite may not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to the 10th generation," and so forth. Rabban Gamliel has an explicit verse. You cannot join the congregation. There's really nothing to debate, except for Rabbi Yeshua's got something to debate. He says, "And are the Ammonites and the Moabites still dwelling in their place? Sanherib, king of Assyria, already arose and blended all the nations, as the verse says. I have removed the borders of the nations, and I have plundered their treasures like a great warrior, laid low the inhabitants." What's Rabbi Yoshua saying here? Keep your finger on the Mishnah. What? There's no such thing as an Ammonite anymore. Just because your name is Ger Ammoni, okay, just because you're called an Ammonite doesn't mean you're really an Ammonite. That's Rabban Gamliel, that's your Torah. I know you've got an explicit verse, but the person I see, he just calls himself an Ammonite. He's not really an Ammonite. Rabban Gamliel said to him, The verse also states, "And afterwards I shall return the captives of the children of Ammon." And they've already returned. Reuben Gamliel says maybe they were mixed up once, but they're back. It says in Jeremiah that they've returned. Rabbi Yeshua says, the verse also states, "And I shall return the captives of my nation Israel and Judah, and they are not yet returned." And the sages subsequently permitted the Ammonite convert to enter into the congregation. Okay, we have a disagreement between Reuben Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua about a really pretty, an extremely explicit verse. Ammonite can never enter the Jewish people. He's excluded. He's on the outside forever. She is excluded forever. Well, he is excluded forever. And Rabbi Yeshua finds a creative way to bring him back in. Why does Rabbi Yeshua find this creative way to bring him back in? What's motivating Rabbi Yeshua? Of course, he wants to be nice, like Vera says. This is like, who wants to look someone in the eye and tell them that they're not wanted and they can't become Jewish? But what prompts him? I'd like to suggest that it's on that very day Yehuda, an Ammonite convert, came and stood before them in the Beit Midrash. Okay, in the larger context, you see that until this day, everyone who wanted to didn't have access to the rabbis. They weren't able to come in and ask whatever their question is. On the day they open the doors to the Beit Midrash, in comes Yehuda Ger Amoni. And instead of seeing Ger Amoni, an Ammonite who's trying to convert, he sees Yehuda. Do you hear what I'm saying? Yehuda means Jew. What do you mean you're an Ammonite? I see here a Jew. If your name is Judah, obviously you can enter the community. For sure you belong. But what I'd like to suggest is that what helps Rabbi Yeshua find and the community of rabbis to admit him to the congregation is the fact that they're looking him in the eye. Because once you're looking someone in the eye, to turn them over, you have a different kind of compassion than you had in your ivory tower. So that's despite the fact that Reuben Gamliel clearly has the simple read, right? Rabbi Yeshua is motivated to find space because he's making eye contact with the person facing him.
Uh-huh. Because it would suggest the word Ger Amoni would suggest that somehow he's already taken steps towards Giyur, or somebody who wants to convert, or somebody, in other words, it's not somebody just walking in off the street.
I think it's someone walking in off the street and he wants to know, can I marry a Jew? Okay, that's the halachic meaning of his question. But the formulation, can I enter the congregation, is a very strong, sounds as though he's coming off of the street.
Is that saying that he's taken Ger Amoni, he's already taken certain steps towards becoming Jewish?
I think he's...
Or that he just has that intent, or he's a Ger in the broader sense of not being Jewish?
You know what, I'm not sure it matters for our situation.
Okay,
but I think that he's Jewish. Okay, he's already converted, and then the question is: once you've converted, can you also marry a Jew, or are you stuck as an outsider forever? Okay, so Rabbi Yeshua, both Rabbi Yeshua, Rav Huna, Rabbi Yochanan, all of them are. Manifest this Torah Chesed, this Torah of kindness and inclusion. And I think that comes out of a place of meeting with the needs of the people, looking into their hearts, getting to know them, it's more than just not being distracted, but having a sense of who they are as more than just Ammonite, more than just person with a deformity or person who's blind. And so there's what we have here is two examples of interpersonal contact which is tempering the strict understanding of the law and is getting a good rep in the Talmud, is really approved of. There are others. I could have brought you other examples, but in the interest of time, I'm going to keep moving, that the rabbis in an ivory tower, but the point is that rabbis who are living in an ivory tower, they're at risk. They're at risk of excessive zealousness for God. And in real life, we have an ability to mediate that zealousness through a deep understanding of Tzelem Elohim and another human being. I want to start with a personal narrative. As I said, this is my raciest class. I've always been a good Orthodox girl. Not always, but for a long time already now, I've been a good Orthodox girl. And I knew that I couldn't be a rabbi. And I knew that women couldn't have aliyot. And the world has changed. And I was submitted to that and was happy to submit to that. And I'll tell you, because of this source that's also number one on page one. I'm turning back to page one. If a case is too baffling for you to decide, be it a controversy over homicide, civil law, or assault, this is Deuteronomy, matters of dispute in courts, you shall promptly repair to the place that the Lord your God will have chosen and appear before the Levitical priests or the magistrate in charge at that time and present your problem. When they've announced to you the verdict of the case, you shall carry out the verdict that is announced to you from the place that God chose, observing scrupulously all their instructions to you. You shall act in accordance with the instructions given to you and the ruling handed down to you. You must not deviate from the verdict that they announced to you, either to the right or the left. Lo tasur mina devar asher yagidu lecha yamin usmol. You have to follow the rule of the rabbis, and I understand from that. That means you have a question, you're not sure what the rule is. You turn to a rabbi, he gives you a psak halacha, and you know what to do. And the responsibility's on him and not on you. And it goes to such an extent that the Yerushalmi suggests even if he tells you al yamin shehu smol, al smol shehu yamin. Meaning, even if you know the rabbi's telling you the wrong thing, you still, says the Yerushalmi, and this is a big controversy, should you still follow the rabbis? But the idea is the responsibility is on the rabbis. And our job is to follow instructions. It's ironic, as you may know, that I was ordained by Rabbi Herzl Hefter and Rabbi Daniel Sperber in 2015, and now I started to think about this a little bit differently. In that, since I was ordained, I've had two incidences where I've been with other rabbis, and people have bigger rabbis. Okay, I'm just like a little rabbi. Bigger rabbis who we were discussing. In one case, it was women's issues. Can a woman count in a minyan, or can women together, a group of 10 women, constitute a minyan? And the rabbi said, I think they can, but women have to do it for themselves. Like, why are you looking to us? Women are a nation to their own. It's up to them to decide. And that made me so mad. Because all of this time, you're telling me, I have to submit. I have to do what you say. And then when you're like, think, well, you could do something, but I'm not going to go out publicly telling you you can do it. Okay, I see some people are outraged. I'm not going to go out there publicly and tell you you can do it. You have to take it on your back, and you have to go out and do it. Okay, the first time I heard that, I was so outraged. And about a year later, I was with a different group of rabbis. This time, it was in a discussion about And it wasn't just with rabbis. This was in a public forum. Something called Pesach Sheni, which is an event for LGBTQ people designed to include them. And they included, and one of the members of the community raises his or her hand and says, I want you to give me some direction, some halacha about how to have my relationships. You know, like I want some guidance. There are so many things you need guidance about, you know, like what are the rules of nigia if I have same-sex attraction, so like let me think it out again when it comes to what does that mean for hugging a person of my same gender, or what does it mean for being alone with a person of my same gender. Yeah, you know, all of those rules need to be thought out again, and the person says, give me some guidance. And all three of the rabbis on the panel, all of them, said, don't look to us for guidance. Just step up there and do something. And again, I was like, what are you saying? Like, why? They're like, don't wait for the rabbis. But we've been taught to always turn to the rabbis and ask them for advice. And so when I heard this twice, in a not such a long time, I started Of course, I carried a lot of rage. You hear a little rage. I'm still carrying a little bit of the rage, but I've looked inwards, and I guess the point of this class is to try to understand what they're getting at, and why it is up to us in some ways. Okay, now taking myself out of the right. I'm just a little rabbi, so I've made my first part of the piece of the argument, which is, rabbis need to see us and our needs, whatever those needs are, up close. And when they see us up close, and I think that this actually was really very profound for my teachers, as I was amongst the first cohorts of advanced women learning, and I think at that time nobody ever thought like it will move forwards, but over the course of 20 years of being in their community over time, they got to know us, and then they started to think differently. How do you think about women maybe why is it exactly that women can't be rabbis? So I think that that moving out of the ivory tower and seeing the needs of the individual, getting to know the individual, and allows us to think about the individual in a different way, and therefore it's important for it's up to us as lay people to advocate for ourselves with the rabbis. But I'd like to suggest more than that. Okay. To look at another story, I'm going to have to, I'm going to give you, even though I'm running a little bit late, I'm still going to give you 3 minutes of Chevruta at the bottom of page 2. The source that's labeled 2, Talmud Psachim 66a, with the goal of asking yourself the question, what's the source of authority, and what's the irony in this story? Okay, what's the source of authority, and where's the irony in this story? Okay, that's Psachim 66a, source number 2, on your market set, go. You've got 3 minutes. Okay, I'm sorry to bring you back, because it's fun and to learn in Chavruta. It's a fun story, right? Okay, this is a pretty fun story. I hope you liked it. I'll show you that it's great. The B'nai B'Tera are sitting at the top of the Sanhedrin, and they know everything except for this one thing, which is what happens when Pesach falls on, when the 14th of Nisan, the day that you offer the Korban Pesach, falls on Shabbos. Okay, this is towards the end of the period of the Beit HaMikdash, in the last century. And why don't they know what to, they don't know, should you, when the day that you offer your Paschal sacrifice falls on Shabbos. Which takes first? Which takes precedence? The Paschal sacrifice or Shabbos? I'm going to suggest that they don't know because it doesn't happen all the time. You know, it's like a kind of rare-ish occurrence, and because it's a, and so they don't remember. Even though it's not such a hard question, they don't remember. And they're looking for somebody who has a mimetic tradition, okay? Not a limud, not a derivation from the Torah, but someone who's got a received tradition. What are we supposed to do in this situation? And it's so beautiful that they turn right to the crowd. Can anyone help us? Who knows the answer to this difficult question? And then I know that there's a certain mythical piece to it, because when they turn to the crowd and Hillel tells them, and they tell them that the answer is, yes, it takes precedence over Shabbat. And how do I know? How does he know, Hillel? He derives it from the verse, okay, in two ways. One, there's a gezerah shava, okay? He can make a comparison from one place where it says moado to another place it says moado. If the everyday sacrifice has to be done in its time, so also they both, and it uses the same language with respect to the everyday sacrifice, so surely this also has to be done in its time. And in addition to that, there's a kal v'chomer, a logical agreement, a logical induction. And when, because after all, the omission of the Paschal sacrifice, offering the Pesach sacrifice, is one of two mitzvot asek, positive commandments that you can get punished for not doing. So if the daily sacrifice takes precedence, so how and you don't get punished if you miss that one, how much the more so does this one, for which you'll get punished if you don't do, take precedence? Wow, B'nai B'Tera are so happy to hear this answer that they vacate their seat immediately and hand it over to Hillel. Okay, that's how you know it's a little bit of a myth, just from what you see. You only have, well, of course they weren't like our politicians, but needless to say. So the humility is a big deal here. But Hillel turns and says, what is it that caused, I'm reading the underlined part, what is it for you that I should come, what caused it for you that I should come up from Babylonian to be in a sea over you? Like, why did I displace you? It was your indolence, because you did not serve the two greatest men of the time, Shammai and Avtalion. And then they ask him one more question. Oi, I've heard this law, he answers, but I've forgotten it. Obviously, the minute that Hillel sits in the big chair in the front and gets a little bit haughty, okay, then he too will start to forget, which shows you something about the danger of the ivory tower, of standing over. But their traditions are traditions of authority, traditions that are derived and traditions that are inherited. And Hillel takes a deep breath and he says, I've heard this law, but I've forgotten it. Hinach lehen l'Yisrael, im ein nevi'in hen, b'nei nevi'in hem. If they're not prophets, they're the children of prophets. And behold, lo and behold, the next day when it came time for the Paschal sacrifice, everybody figured out what to do. They all had an intuition. They put the knife tucked in the hair like a hair clip for the animal, for the lamb, or if it was a goat, they tucked it behind their horns as a pretty decoration, and the animals carried it themselves. When he saw the incident, he said, "Oh yeah, that's what I received in the tradition from my teacher Shemaya ben Avtalion." The irony. What's the irony of the story? The people already knew. We thought that the inheritance of authority comes from tradition, comes from learning. And it turns out, meaning that it has to be passed down from rabbi to rabbi or derived from sitting in the Beit Midrash and using the tools of the Beit Midrash. And it turns out that it comes from prophecy also. That Hillel can take a deep breath and trust the people. What does it mean? Hinach lehem li'Yisrael. Im lo nevi'im hem b'nei nevi'im hem. They are prophets, which is not about a handed down tradition. A prophet gets their traditions straight into their little head. Okay, God spoke directly to the people. The way that this is usually understood is that there's a certain, that God has a certain providence over us and gives us an intuition that doesn't allow us to go the wrong way. And we can trust our intuition and follow our intuition. Our intuition is a kind of Torah and should be trusted. I'd like to suggest that the next two little stories tell the next two little passages where have similar ideas. In source 3, you see there's a disagreement. One who drinks water to quench thirst says, Shakol Nia Bivaro, that's the, Brain Official Rabot, the Chesronan. There's a I was right the first time. There's a disagreement about what to say. This is in the Mishnah. We just learned this, right? So the Mishnah says, what should you say when you drink water? Should you say Shakol Nia Bidvaro? Or Rabbi Tarfon says Brei Defasho Rabot V'Chesronan, which is the bracha we usually say after we drink a glass of water. And the question is, what's the halacha? What's the rule? Amar like Puk Chaze Mai Amadiber. Go forth and see how the nation has spoken. I don't know what the halacha is. Rabbi Hanan says, what I know is that the people will know. Let's just check in with them and see what their position is on the halacha. So too in the Yerushalmi. Okay, that expression, Puk Chaze Mai Amadiber, three times in the Bavli. Three times it says, we're not sure what the halacha is. Let's trust the people to figure it out and turn to them for advice or to decide. So too in the Yerushalmi, Kol halacha shehi rofefet bebeitin ve'ein at yodea mativa tse ure'e heach tzibor noheg unhog. Every time there's a halakha in the court that you're not sure what the ruling should be, go out and see what the community is doing and follow the community. Follow the lead of the people. Tell me your name.
I think this is really the answer to those two groups of rabbis that annoyed you so much. This is what they were saying to you. They were saying, you have a responsibility as the people, Am Yisrael, go out and you to tell us. Solomon Shechter had a name for this. It was called Catholic Israel, Kahal Yisrael, what the Jewish people as a whole do. Now, there's Sephardic Jews, there are Ashkenazi Jews, they want a different meaning, but still, eventually, there becomes a voice of the people. Right now, a voice of that segment of the people is saying there should be female rabbis. A voice of a segment of people said there should be accepted gay. There's another.
Perfect. Stop there. I can go home.
Right.
The class is over. That's the point. Okay? That is exactly the point. That's what the rabbis were saying. Eventually, history will work itself out. And the rabbis, it wasn't that the decision about what is halakha comes from above in negotiation with the rest of us. And it's up to us to advocate for our position. First Amalia, then Jonathan. Well, hold on, Jonathan, let Jonathan, and then I'll come back to you, Vera. Yes. These are good questions. Vera, we want to add something? So good to be in a friendly audience. This isn't fair. Okay, says Amalia. What's it that when it's not convenient for you, you tell me that I don't have power and privilege. And then when it's convenient for you, when you don't want to have the responsibility, because it goes power, privilege, and responsibility together. And when there's power and privilege, then we aren't allowed to play. And then suddenly when there's responsibility, then they step back and say, you know, you have the power. How are we going to know who those people are? I think that is a million-dollar question, but I think that what this passage is saying, im lo nevi'im hem, b'nei nevi'im hem, is a trust in the people as a whole, an understanding that it will work itself out. And I mean, I'll say just how I personally answer it, is that we're in it for the long run, and time will tell. Okay, you know, you've heard of wisdom of the crowd. I think this is about wisdom of the crowd. How do you, Cervicki? Wrote that. Okay, I'll tell you about him. His name is Cervicki. Cervicki James. And he wrote a book called Wisdom of the Crowds. He did this experiment. He didn't do it, but he's writing about this experiment where there's a big animal, and everybody gets to take a guess at how many pounds of flesh are in that animal. And 1,000 people took guesses, and no one was right. No one got it right. But the average of all of the answers was precise. And that the idea of wisdom of the crowd is that you need those outliers, the people who are 200 off and 200 off in this direction and 200 off in that direction, because the experts, you think experts really know what they're talking about, But experts, as we know, have limited vision. Okay, they're living in their ivory tower. They have certain, they have a certain perspective. They have a, they're biased. They've got mistaken assumptions. They don't see the whole picture. And the wisdom of the crowd balances out by offering an offering a range of perspectives. And together, as a community, it finds exactly where it needs to be. And that's the idea of Im lo nevi'im hem b'nei nevi'im hem. That together they had, the people as a whole, not every individual, right? Not every individual, but the Jewish people as a whole. Revach v'hatzalat avo mimakom achad. God is going to look out for us. God will make sure that we get where we need to go. God's protecting us. And I don't know exactly who's the person that's 200 off, Jonathan, in that direction. And I don't know who's the person that's 200 off in this direction. But over the course of 100 years, then we'll know. Okay? Because God is going to guide us with God's invisible hand to the place where we need to go. And it's our job to like try to be as close as we can to God's left finger or right finger as we possibly can be. And maybe we'll be 200 off, but I trust that if we're 200 off, God will balance it out on this side. And if we're 300 off, God will balance it off on this side. And together, we'll get there. And so we should go ahead and give it our best guess. We have to give it our best guess because that's the only way to get to the in-between, the wisdom of the crowd, and that is the articulation of, I believe that's what's being articulated here in these three passages and these general principles. Sarah.
I just feel like you can't be like, well, if the majority wants it, so it must be the right thing. You know, like, I hear what you're saying because I also, like, I do think women should be rabbis, and I do think, like, all these things, but I also feel like that's not, it can't, like, that, it, you know what I'm sorry.
It's not go with the majority. It's trust the nevuah that God is giving you. Trust the nevuah that God is giving. You have to look in. Okay, it's going to be in combination together with the rabbis because the halacha is coming from above and it's coming in negotiation with below. And by the way, okay, so there's five examples on your sheet. I don't have time to do too many of them, but I'll say outside a couple of what's on here, okay? Because I love them and I want to make sure to respect your time. The first one, you know, people didn't used to speak Hebrew. Hebrew was a language that was reserved for holy things. And there was a question at the beginning of the state of Israel. Should you speak in Hebrew or write things in Hebrew? If you write things in Hebrew, then can you bring them into the bathroom? Can you geniza them? It's the holy language. Lashon HaKodesh, because it's Lashon HaKodesh. And the answer is, let Israel be. If they're not prophets, they're the children of prophets. And you see that it's come out. I think for us it's a given that we should speak in Hebrew, that it helps us. And isn't it that those of us who are studying at Pardes and killing ourselves over learning Hebrew are so envious of the people that, as it says here, the Brit Kahuna defended this lenient practice because of its great benefit to the house of Israel in making Hebrew known to the masses, which makes it easier for us to learn Torah. It's like, how much time do we spend learning Torah, taking vocabulary tests? The people who got Hebrew as their original language are so lucky. You know, there's a question about secular melodies. Maybe, okay, there's another. That's the second example. I'm skipping it because I am respecting your time. There's an explicit Mishnah in source number 7. That ein podin et shvuim b'yetzer al demehem mipnei tikkun olam. You're not allowed to. I cited the Rambam here, but it's still an explicit Mishnah. You're not allowed to pay more for a refugee. Here they're imagining a slave, okay, on the slave market more than their value. It's an explicit law. And yet, the whole nation of Israel, the Radbaz says, even the Rambam writes it in the 12th century, and only 300 or 400 years later, the Radbaz writes, Kfar nahagu kol Yisrael liftot et shvuehem yoter midei kedei demehem anim karim bashuk. The Jewish people don't follow this rule at all. They pay way too much for their fellow Jews on the slave market. What can you do? They've got so much compassion. You can't hold them to the law. The law changes and adjusts because the people have a moral intuition that you have to that you have to redeem, and we go with that moral intuition. Similarly, once upon a time, in Source 11, once upon a time, the custom was that women went out with not one but two head coverings, perhaps even covering their face. And if she didn't, it was cause for divorce. But Rav Avadya Yosef says, by definition, there's no reason to object to a woman's current permissive custom, he means, of covering your hair once. By definition, the reason is because custom comes and overrules custom. Custom changes. The people decide, and they've overruled that custom. And so even if unmarried girls who don't tie their hair back at all, according to the Megein Avraham, or don't cover their hair at all, according to the Megein Avraham, since it's merely a matter of modesty, custom comes and overrides custom. That is to say, custom can change. The moral intuition of the people in the 12th century was different in the 15th century, and that was halacha, and this is halacha, because we trust the intuition of the people to make the right decision. I skipped the same thing about the Rambam. Says you can beat your wife if you have to in Source 9 and Source 10. It's like, what the heck are you talking about? We don't beat our wives. And that's halacha, by the way. Do not beat your wife. Okay. You didn't need to come here for that. I hope you didn't need to come here for that. The Chazon Ish says, Haskamat HaTzibur Kekoach Beit Din. Okay, I can't fix for Amalia. What I can say is that we have to step up and to keep demanding. Okay, that we have a... The text tells us it's not just these two rabbis who wanted to dodge responsibility, that they put the responsibility back on me, but I think that there's actually some things that have to come from the people pushing. And when we push, I go back to Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan at the beginning, the eye contact that they made with the blind person or the runny-eyed person, the eye contact they made with the Ammonite, because those people demanded, that's what pushed the halakha to change, and that is a halachic consideration, something that is correct to push in that direction. Okay, let me take a few minutes to talk about why I actually think, Amalia, that this is what I would say to you. I think it's changing, okay? I would say that I think that these are changes that you can't expect, or I don't know. The world is, David Bernstein, the dean of this institution, has told me many times, because I've been teaching here for 20 years, that teachers are the most conservative profession in existence. Like, teachers always want to do things like it used to be, and hold on to tradition. And I think he's wrong. Rabbis are the most traditional, profession. And there's good reasons for why they are as traditional as they are. First of all, tradition. Okay, we come to rabbis because we love tradition. We embrace tradition. We want tradition. Second of all, the rabbinic principle of do no harm. Right, like whatever you do, Rabbi, don't better to do nothing at all than to get involved and do the wrong thing. There's a big disadvantage to that principle. But It's also a principle for doctors. There's a reason for that principle, and the rabbis feel that principle very strongly. The rabbis are very careful about change, and so I think that it's that it does. If we don't show them that there's a problem, that there's a need, we can't expect things to change. And I do think that. I'll say that I think that things are changing, okay? In 2001, the first partnership minyan was started, not by a rabbi. I mean, by someone who has smicha, but someone who started this minyan because he wanted his daughter to have a bat mitzvah. And now there are nearly 50 minyanim in America. 50 minyanim around, 35, I think, in the United States. Well, this is what's on the JOFA website. I imagine that there's many that aren't on the JOFA website, but there's about 50. There's at least 50 minyanim. There's a guidebook out there about how to run these minyanim by two people called Michal and Eli Tzor Bar Asher Siegel. They're professors. They're not rabbis. And Rabbi Alan Haber wrote about in the Jerusalem Post. It may very well be that there are halachically acceptable ways to do much of what they advocate. However, the process by which they arrived at these conclusions is not a legitimate halachic process. Halacha does insist that every generation has certain leaders whose authority derives from their widespread acceptance, particularly when attempting to break the established practice. The approval of recognized authorities is essential. You have to have decision. You need a rabbi. Its authors are not rabbis and are seeking to determine by lay decision-making matters on which rabbinic Judaism defers to rabbis. That is a fundamental deficiency. More than anything else, halacha requires submission to the authority of poskim, halachic deciders. One is free to choose a halachic authority who shares one's own worldview, but you have to submit to the authorities. And I think that you see that the fact that now there are 50 of these, he's exactly, excuse me, that I am going to exactly disagree with Rabbi Haber, right? That's a way of saying, I want to hold on to tradition. I want to hold on to my power. And as soon as there are 50 of these minyanim, okay, just 15 years later, there's 15 of those minyanim. In another 15 years, if they're let's say there are 150 of those minyanim. In another 15 years, there are 1,000 of those minyanim. Now that's already a minhag. Okay, so we have to take it on the head in the meantime. The same thing, but I'm trusting, right, there's the guess that it could be, I do think it's possible that those minyanim are going to fall off, that maybe they're 200 to this side, and somebody's going to, and they're going to be left off in the middle is somewhere in between. I'm ready to trust I'm Israel to get to the right place, but it's my job to follow my conscience and to move in that direction. We had just last week, 65 rabbis last week were condemning shuls that employ rabbaniyot. Okay. Rabot v'rabbaniyot, which comes on the back of the first decree was made, of course. In 2009, Rabbi Avi Weiss established the Maharat program and ordained Sarah Horovitz. In 2010, the RCA came out with the first condemnation. In 2013, the second condemnation. In 2015, there was a special condemnation. Well, it's special to me because after I got ordained, me with my Israeli compatriots at Midrashet Lindebaum, they issued another condemnation. In 2017, they released a big psak. And in 2018, they threatened to enforce it. In 2019, they're threatening to enforce it again. And you see, I don't have to say anything, okay? It's now there are 65, there are 25 alumni of Maharat, and there's 30 more in the pipeline. There's another dozen or so here in Israel. And all of the Maharats are employed. Every single one. There's huge demand for Maharats. Anyone who wants, so it's a good job if you're thinking about being a Maharat. Your employment prospects are outstanding because the people have spoken. Once there's a shul that has four rabbis, of course they want one of them to be a rabbi, to be a woman. You need everyone. Women want to talk to women. Men sometimes need to talk to women. Everybody, obviously. obviously you need women's voices. And so the Ha'am Diber, and the rabbis are protesting, but the change is happening in the world. Last year we had a student here, Micha Tau, who was a student at Shul Hevet High School. And he suffered for years, afraid to come out of the closet because he thought he didn't know what the community was going to say. He was at an Orthodox high school. And he came out. When he came out, everything was okay, but he said, my gosh, why did I have to suffer? Right? He was like, I can cry just thinking about it. You know, like what it's like to be a 16-year-old boy in an Orthodox high school and wondering what your family and your friends and your teachers and everyone you respect in your community is going to say to you when you come out of the closet, or if you come out of the closet. Well, you don't have to. I don't need to tell you about the research you're probably aware of. So he composed this pledge, right? He composed this pledge and is campaigning with high schools together with the people. You can go to the Eshel. Eshel is the organization focused in America that works with, that supports Orthodox people with same-sex attraction. So our school, or LGBT people in general, our school strives to be a nurturing and inclusive environment for all of our students. This is our policy for Kavod HaBriyut and Derech Eretz, no expulsion, no bullying, no reparative therapy, support, integration, open admission. And he's challenging high schools across the country to take the pledge, to promise to be accepted. And he's calling on you to go online and make a little video and send to your high school and demand you take that pledge. And it's going to come from people going online and demanding that you take that pledge. Now, halacha, all of these things that I'm talking about, I think most of them are in the realm of minhag. Okay, they're custom. I'm not saying that anything, right? No, even if all the people in the world tell you to worship the golden calf, you cannot go and worship the golden calf. Okay, but I think, and so. And I'm a little rabbi. I'm going to say a sentence, I can tell you where there's legislation in the Shulchan Aruch that legislates explicitly against same-sex intimacy, sex. But I can't tell you where in the Shulchan Aruch it says that you can't have same-sex life partners. And I think that is the place where we're going to start. Is we're not going to get up and say, we're the same as you've never seen me kiss my husband. It will be, we're not going to see people, what happens between people is going to remain private. And I don't think it's going to be fast. Maybe it is going to be fast. We'll see what the people will say. But I think that first we could easily have people committing themselves to lifelong relationships. And it doesn't say anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch you cannot commit yourself to lifelong relationships. And it's obvious that we want people to lo tov hiyota adam levado. It's not good for people to be alone. So people who have same-sex attraction, and it's not going to be reasonable for them to be married to someone of the opposite sex, they need to have, tradition would want them to have a partner. I don't think that you're going to get a rabbi to stand up there and say it. But I think, I mean, you see, okay, even a member of Shas went to such a wedding. He went to such a wedding because it was his nephew and he wanted his nephew to be happy. And because Rav Huna wanted his Kohen to be able to raise his hands because no one, and that's where the push has to come from us. And I think that when the push does come from us, I think that we'll see that there will be a moving in the, and you know, where that is to say, I don't know what's going to happen in 100 years, but I trust the wisdom of the crowd. I trust the nevuah. Im lo nevi'im hem, b'nei nevi'im hem. The Jewish people will know what to do in the long run, perhaps not, and some things will be left out in the cold, but we have to stick to our conscience, that our conscience is a form of intuition in negotiation, of course, right? It's not just whatever we feel like doing. Let's go worship the golden calf, but in deep relationship with halacha, with the love for tradition, with a submission to halacha, that has to combine with our deep understanding of what God wants from us. And I do believe that, you know, if not this week, I think that in 50 years, it's obvious to me that the RCA will have changed their decision about, they won't have issued 150th, you know, they're going very well right now with a one-a-year condemnation of women rabbis. I think that in 50 years, they'll have slowed down and have found space for me in the tent, just as Rabbi Yoshua found space in the tent for Yehuda Ger Amoni, and Rav Huna found space in the tent for his Zalbagan, his runny-eyed congregant, and Rabbi Yochanan found room for his blind congregant. I think there'll be room for, I pray, I trust that there will be room for all of us, and we just have to stick with our conscience at the same time, be in dialogue and hold strong with our power. And thank you very much. I'm happy to take comments and questions, but I want to also respect people's time. Alan.
Very, very positive, very nice, but it's the thing that's holding up the march forward, which is the concept of Gadol Hador, that they say are only certain rabbis that are the great rabbis, the luminaries of the generation. And as far as I know, except for maybe Rabbi Sperber, who is also considered a Gadol Hador of the Orthodox world, most of the others, if not all the others, are against female rabbis, gay issues, and all these other things. And unless they change, it's not going to happen.
Okay, unless the rabbis change, it's not going to happen. I think that the rabbis are going to change because we are going to be in their face, Rav Huna, like we were in the face of Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan. And it may take them some time, but we have to keep waiting until there's a minhag. And if there's not a minhag, then I guess we'll have been wrong. But I believe there will be a minhag. I forgot your name.
Well, I never gave it.
Okay.
Do you see any significant differences in trends or constraints as you see them here in Israel vis-a-vis what exists in the United States?
No question that America is a... I got your question. There's a big difference between Israel and America. Israel is much more diffuse in its authority structure than America. There's not an RCA in America, in Israel, and so therefore I think that the Rabot and Rabaniot in this country have had a better time of it. And there's also a group here. There's a number of groups of gay LGBT Jews of all kinds, and I think that it's much easier in this country for you to do you. Okay. Anybody else?
I just find that a bit paradoxical because in Israel you do have the Rabbanut as an authority, in fact, by government, yet you're saying there's more space than there would be in the United States.
The Rabbanut isn't so strong here. I pray that we'll have, either we'll get rid of it altogether, or we'll get one that's that really can stand for the entirety of the Jewish people. I thank you all very much, and good night.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.